Chapter 11. Survivors. Aftermath. I will break him. Buoyed upon hot currents of air vented by the furious abyss, what was left of the assault boats carrying the Astartes strike force made their escape from Baca Triumvirate 14 and back to the Rothful, held in orbit around the moon. Cestus was waiting for the atmospheric craft in the tertiary docking bay when a single vessel touched down. Its outer hull shielding was badly scorched, and its engines were all but burned out as it thunked to an unwieldy stop on the metal deck. One assault boat, thought the ultramarine captain, waiting with Saffrax and Liradis, the apothecary ready with his Narthesium injector. How many casualties did we sustain? Engineering deckhands hurried back and forth, hosing down the superheated aspects of the boat with coolant foam and brandishing tools to effect immediate repairs. One of the officers stood at a distance with a data slate, already compiling an initial damage report. Cestus was oblivious to them all, his gaze fixed on the embarkation ramp as it ground open slowly with a hiss of venting pressure. Bryngar and his blood claws stepped out of the compartment. The ultramarine greeted him cordially enough. "Well met, son of Russ." Bryngar grunted a response, his demeanour still hostile, and turned to one of his charges.
"Rougefelt, bring him out."
One of the blood claws, a youth with bright orange hair worked into a mohawk and a short beard festooned with wolf fetishes, nodded and went back into the crew compartment. When he returned, he was not alone. A pale-faced warrior was with him, his hands and forearms encased by restraints linked by an adamantium cord, his face fraught with cuts and a massive purple-black bruise over one eye the size of Bryngar's fist. Bent-backed and obviously weak, he had a defiant air about him still. He wore the armour of the 15th Legion, the armour of the Word-Bearers.
"We have ourselves a prisoner,"
Bryngar snarled, stalking past the trio of ultramarines without explanation, his blood claws with their prize in tow.
"Find me an isolation cell,"
Cestus overheard the Wolfguard say to one of his battle brothers.
"I intend to find out what he knows."
Cestus kept his eyes forward for a moment, striving to master his anger.
"My lord,"
ventured Saffrax, the banner-bearer clearly noticing his captain's distemper.
"Son of Russ,"
Cestus said levelly, knowing he would be heard. The sound of the departing space wolves echoing down the deck was the only reply.
"Son of Russ,"
he bellowed this time and turned, his expression set as if in stone. Bryngar had almost reached the deck portal when he stopped.
"I would have your report, brother," said Cestus calmly, "and I would have it now."
The Wolfguard turned slowly, his massive bulk forcing the blood claws close by to step aside. Anger and belligerence were etched on his face as plain as the Legion symbols on his armour.
"The assault failed," he growled. "The furious abyss is still intact. There, you have my report."
Cestus fought to keep his voice steady and devoid of emotion.
"What of Antigis and Skral?"
Bryngar was breathing hard, his anger boiling, but at the mention of the two captains, particularly Antigis, his expression softened for a moment.
"We were the only survivors,"
he replied quietly, and continued on through the deck portal to the passageways beyond that would lead eventually to the isolation chambers. Cestus stood for a moment, allowing it to sink in. Antigis had been his battle brother for almost 20 years. They had fought together on countless occasions. They had brought the light of the Emperor to countless worlds in the darkest reaches of the known galaxy.
"What are your orders, my captain?"
asked Saffrax, ever the pragmatist. Cestus crushed his grief quickly. It would serve no purpose here.
"Get Admiral Kaminska. Tell her we are to continue pursuit of the furious abyss at once, with all speed."
"At your command, my lord."
Saffrax snapped a strong salute and left the dock, heading for the bridge. Cestus's plan had failed, catastrophically. More than 60% casualties were unacceptable. It left only the Ultramarine's honour guard, still stationed aboard ship by way of contingency, and Bryngar's blood claws. The Space Wolf's continued defiance was developing into open hostility. Something was building. Even without the animal instincts of the Sons of Russ, Cestus could feel it. He wondered how long it would be before the inevitable storm broke. Here they were, at war with their fellow legions. Gilliman only knew how deep the treachery went, how many more legions had turned against the Emperor. If anything, the loyal legions needed desperately to draw together, not to fight internecine conflicts between themselves in the name of petty disagreements. When the final reckoning came, where would Bryngar and his legion sit? Gilliman and his ultramarines were dogmatic in their fealty to the Emperor. Could the same be said of Rus? Cestus left such dark thoughts behind him for now, knowing it would not aid him or their mission to dwell on them. Instead, his mind turned briefly to Antigues. In all likelihood, he was dead. His brother, his closest friend, slain in what had been a fool's cause. Cestus cursed himself for allowing Antigues to take his place. Saffrax was an able adjutant. His dedication to the teachings of Gilliman was unshakable, but he was not the confidant that Antigues had been. Cestus clenched his fist. This deed will not go unavenged.
Leradis, with me, said the ultramarine captain, marching off in the direction that Bryngar had taken.
The apothecary fell into lockstep behind him.
Where are we going, captain?
I want to know what happened on Bacca Triumvirum, and I want to find out what our word-bearer knows about his legion's ship and their mission to Macragge.
By the time Cestus and Leradis reached the isolation cells, Bryngar was already inside, the door sealed with Rougeveld standing guard. The isolation cells were located in the lower decks, where the heat and sweat of the engines could be heard and felt palpably. Toiling ratings below sang gritty naval chants to aid them in their work, and the resonant din carried through the metal. It was a muffled chorus down the gloom-drenched passages that Cestus and Leradis had travelled to reach this point.
"Step aside, Bloodclaw," ordered Cestus without preamble.
At first, it looked as if Rougeveld would disobey the ultramarine, but Cestus was a captain, albeit from a different legion, and that position commanded respect. The Bloodclaw lowered his gaze, indicating his obedience, and gave ground. Cestus thumbed the door release icon as he stood before the cell portal. The bare metal panel slid aside, two thin jets of vapour escaping as it did so. A darkened chamber beckoned, barely illuminated in the half-light of loom globes set to low emit. A bulky shape stood within, with two shrivelled, robed forms on either side. Bryngar had stripped out of his armour, aided by two attendant legion serfs. The menials kept their heads low and their tongues still. The Wolfguard was naked from the waist up, wearing only simple grey battle fatigues. His torso was covered in old wounds, scars and faded, pinkish welts creating a patchwork history of pain and battle. Standing without his armour, his immense musculature obvious and intimidating, and with a great mass of his hair hanging down, Bryngar reminded the ultramarine of a barbarian of ancient terror, the kind that he had seen rendered in frescoes in some of the great antiquariums. The Wolfguard turned at the interruption, the shadow of another figure strapped down in a metal restraint frame, partly visible for a moment, before the Space Wolf's bulk took up the space again.
"What do you want, Cestus? I'm sure you can see that I'm busy."
Bryngar's knuckles were hard and white as he clenched his fists. As he had stormed from the tertiary dock after the Space Wolf and his battle brothers, Cestus had thought to intervene, the idea of torturing a fellow Legion brother abhorrent to him. Now, standing at the threshold of the isolation chamber, he realized just how desperate their plight had become, and that victory might call for compromise. Just how far this compromise would go and where it would eventually lead, Cestus did not care to think. It was what it was. They were on this course now, and the word-bearers were enemies like any other. They had not hesitated when they destroyed the waning moon, nor had they paused to consider their actions during the slaughter on Bacca Triumvirum 14.
"I would speak to you again, Bryngar," the ultramarine captain said. "Once this is over, I would know the details of what happened on Bacca." "Aye, lad," the Space Wolf nodded, a glimmer of their old rapport returning briefly to his features.
Cestus glimpsed the prone form of their prisoner as Bryngar turned back to his work.
"Do only what is necessary," the ultramarine warned, "and do it quickly. I am leaving Leradis here to assist you, if he can."
The apothecary shifted uncomfortably beside Cestus, whether at the thought of partaking in torture or the prospect of being left alone with Bryngar, the ultramarine's captain did not know. Bryngar looked over his shoulder just as Cestus was leaving.
"I will break him,"
he said, with a predatory gleam in his eye.
We hid behind Becca Triumvirum to keep the Furious Abyss from sending torpedoes after us. We're heading on course for a warp jump vector as we speak.
Kaminska was, as ever, on station at her command throne on the bridge. Safrax was there also, straight-backed and dour as ever. Cestus had headed there alone after leaving Liradis with Bryngard in the isolation chamber. In the scant reports he'd received from the Admiral regarding information gleaned from the assault boat pilot, Cestus had learned a little more of what had happened at Bakka. They'd lost the other two assault boats during the extraction, swallowed up by the fire of the Furious's engines that had turned much of Bakka Triumvirum 14 into a smoking wasteland of charred and twisted metal. The tactical readouts aboard ship had disclosed precious little, save that it was chaotic and not to plan. One of Gilliman's edicts of wisdom was that any plan, however meticulously devised, seldom survives contact with the enemy. The Primarch spoke, of course, of the need for flexibility and adaptation when at war. Cestus thought he should have heeded those words more closely. It appeared also that the word-bearers had been forewarned of the Astartes attack, a fact that he resolved to discover the root of. He considered briefly the possibility of a traitor in their ranks aboard the Wrathful, but dismissed the thought quickly, partly because to countenance such a thing would breed only suspicion and paranoia, and also because to do so would implicate the Astartes captains, or Kaminska.
"What of our prisoner, Captain Cestus?"
asked Kaminska, after consulting the battery of view screens in front of her, satisfied that all necessary preparations were under way for pursuit.
"He is resting uncomfortably with Bryngar,"
the Ultramarine replied, his gaze locked on the prow-facing viewport.
"You believe he knows something about the ship that we can use to our advantage?"
Cestus's response was taciturn, as he thought grimly of the road ahead, and of their options dwindling like parchment before a flame.
"Let us hope so."
Kaminska allowed a moment's pause before she spoke again.
"I am sorry about Antigis. I know he was your friend."
Cestus turned to face her.
"He was my brother."
Kaminska's voxbeed chirped, interrupting the sentiment of the moment.
"We have reached the jump point, Captain," she said. "If we hit the warp now, Orcadus has a chance of finding the Furious Abyss again." "Engage the warp drives," said Cestus.
Kaminska gave the order, and after a few minutes the Wrathful shuddered as the integrity fields leapt up around it, ready for its re-entry into the warp. Zadkiel prayed to the bodies in front of him. The word-bearer was situated in one of the many chapels within the lower decks of the Furious Abyss. It was a modest, relatively unadorned chamber, with a simple shrine etched with the scriptures of Lorgar and lit by votive candles set in baroque-looking candelabras. The room, besides being the ship's morgue, also offered solace and the opportunity to consider the divinity of the Primarch's word, of his teachings, and the power of faith and the warp. Prayer was a complicated matter. On the crude, fleshly level, it was just a stream of words spoken by a man. It was little wonder that imperial conquerors, without an understanding of what faith truly was, saw the prayers of primitive people and discarded them as dangerous superstition and a barrier to genuine enlightenment. They saw the holy books and sacred places and ascribed them not to faith or a higher understanding, but to stupidity, blindness, and an adherence to divisive, irrelevant traditions. They taught an imperial truth in the place of those simple religions, and wiped out any evidence that faith had once been a reality to those worlds. Sometimes that erasure was done with flames and bullets. More often it was done with iterators, brilliant diplomats and philosophers who could re-educate whole populations. Zadkiel's belief, the root of his vainglorious conviction, was that the throne of Terror would be toppled not by the strength of arms wielded by the War Master, nor even by the denizens of the warp, but by faith. Simple and indissoluble, the purity of it would burn through the Imperium like a holy spear, setting the non-believers and their effigies of science and empirical delusion alight. Zadkiel shifted slightly in his kneeling position, abruptly aware that another presence was in the chapel morgue with him.
"Speak," he uttered calmly, eyes closed.
"My lord, it is I, Reskiel," the sergeant commander announced.
Zadkiel could hear the creak of his armour as he bowed, in spite of the fact that he could not see him.
"I would know the fate of Captain Belanus, sire," Reskiel continued after a moment's pause. "Was he recovered?" Doubtless the ambitious Kerr sought to supplant the stricken assault captain in Zadkiel's command hierarchy, or manoeuvre for greater power and influence in the fleet. This did not trouble the word-bearer admiral. Reskill was easy to manipulate. His ambition far outweighed his ability, a fact that was easy to exploit and control. Unlike Altis, whose youthful idealism and fearlessness threatened him, Zadkiel was sanguine about Reskill's prospects for advancement.
"Though mortally injured, the good captain was indeed recovered," Zadkiel told him. "His body has gone into its fugue state in order to heal."
Zadkiel turned at that remark, looking the sergeant commander in the eye.
"Belanus will be incapacitated for some time, Captain. This only strengthens your position in my command."
"My lord, I don't mean to imply..."
"No, of course not, Reskill,"
Zadkiel interjected with a mirthless smile.
"But you have suffered for our cause, and such sacrifice will not go unrewarded. You will assume Belanus's duties."
Reskill nodded. The World Eater had shattered the bones down one side of his skull, and his face had been reinforced with a metal web bolted to his cheek and jaw.
"We have lost many brothers this day," he said, indicating the Astartes corpses laid out before his lord. "They are not lost," said Zadkiel.
Each of the slain word-bearers was set upon a mortuary slab, ready for their armour to be removed and their gene seed recovered. One of them lay with his eyes staring blankly at the ceiling. Zadkiel closed them reverently.
"Only if the word had no place for them would they be lost."
"What of Altis?"
Zadkiel surveyed the array of the dead. "He fell at Bacca," he lied, "and the scholar Coven with him."
Reskill clenched his teeth in anger.
"Damn them!" "We will not damn anyone, Reskill," said Zadkiel sharply, "nor even will Lorgar. The Emperor's gun dogs will damn themselves.
We should turn about and blast them out of real space.
You, Sergeant Commander, are in no place to say what this ship should and should not do. In the presence of these loyal brothers, do not debase yourself by forgetting your purpose."
Zadkiel did not have to raise his voice to convey his displeasure. "Please forgive me, Admiral. I have lost brothers."
"We have all lost something. It was written that we would lose much before we are victorious. We should not expect anything else. We will not engage the wrathful in a fight, because to do so would use up time that we no longer have to spare, and our mission depends on its timing. Cor Pharaon will not be late, so neither will we. Besides, we have other options when dealing with a wrathful."
"You mean Wasoric?" Zadkiel clenched his fist in a moment of unsuppressed emotion.
"It is not appropriate for his name to be spoken here. Make the cathedral ready to receive him."
"Of course," said Reskill. "And the surviving Astartes?"
"Hunt him down and kill him," said Zadkiel.
Reskill saluted and walked out of the chapel mortuary. Certain that the sergeant commander was gone, Zadkiel gestured to the shadows from which a clandestine guest emerged. Magos Guriod shuffled into the light of the votive candle slowly, mechadendrites clicking like insectoid claws.
"You have received Belanus?"
the admiral asked. The Magos nodded.
"All is prepared, my lord."
"Then begin his rebirth at once." Guriod bowed and left the chamber. Now truly alone, Zadkiel looked back at the bodies lying arranged in front of him. In another chamber, together with the many crew of the Furious who had died, were the enemy Astartes, slain in the engine room and the cathedral. They would not receive benediction. They would have refused such an honour, even if it could be given, because they did not understand what prayer and faith meant. They would never be given their place in the Word. They had forsaken it. Those Astartes, the declared enemies of Lorgar, were the ones who were truly lost. An hour after the Wrathful had entered the warp, Cestus went to the isolation chambers. Upon his arrival, he found Rougeveld still dutifully in his position. This time, though, the Bloodclaw stepped aside without being ordered and offered no resistance, it being ostensibly clear that the Ultramarine would brook none. The gloom of the isolation come interrogation chamber was as Cestus remembered it, although now the air was redolent of copper and sweat.
"What progress have you made?" the Ultramarine captain asked of Leradis, who stood at the edge of the room.
The apothecary's face was ashen as he faced his brother captain and saluted.
"None,"
he hissed. "Nothing?" asked Cestus, nonplussed. "He hasn't yielded any information whatsoever."
"No, my lord."
"Bryngar?" "Your apothecary has the strength of it,"
grumbled the Space Wolf, his back to Cestus, body heaving up and down with the obvious effort of his interrogations. When he turned, Bryngar's face was haggard, and his beard and much of his torso were flecked with blood. His meaty fists were angry and raw.
"Is he alive?"
Cestus asked, concern creeping into his voice, not at the fate of their prisoner, but at the prospect that they might have lost their one and only piece of leverage.
"He lives," Bryngar answered, "but by the oceans of Fenris he is tight-lipped. He has not even spoken his name."
Cestus felt his spirit falter for a moment. Time was running out. How many more warp jumps until they reached Macragge? How many more opportunities would they get to stop the word-bearers? It was irrational to even comprehend that one ship, even one such as the Furious Abyss, could possibly threaten Macragge and the Legion. Surely, even the mere presence of the orbital fleet above the Ultramarine's homeworld would be enough to stop it, let alone Gilliman and the Legion mustering at nearby Kalth. Something else was happening, however, events that as of yet Cestus had no knowledge of. The Furious Abyss was a piece of a larger plan. He could sense it, and one that posed a very real danger. They needed to break this word-bearer, and quickly find out what he knew and a way to stop the ship and its inexorable course. Bryngar was possibly the most physically intimidating Astartes he had ever known, aside from the glory and majesty of the noble Primarch. If he, with all his bulk and feral savagery, could not break the traitor, then who could?
"There is but one avenue left open to us," said Cestus, the answer suddenly clear, even though it was an answer muddied with the utmost compromise.
Bryngar held Cestus's gaze, his eyes narrowed as he fought to discern the Ultramarine's meaning.
"Speak, then," he said.
"We release Motep,"
Cestus answered simply. Bryngar roared his dissent. Motep sat in quiet contemplation in the quarters made ready for him aboard the Wrathful. As ordered, he had not left the relatively spartan chamber since his incarceration after he had vanquished the Fireblade. He sat, naked of his armour, in robes afforded to him by attendant legion serfs long since departed, in deep meditation. His gaze was fixed upon the reflective surface of the room's single viewport, pouring into the unfathomable depths of psychic space and communion. When the door to his cell slid open, Motep was not surprised. He had followed the strands of fate, witnessed and understood the web of possibility that brought him to this point, this meeting.
"Captain Cestus," muttered the Thousand Sun with an air of prescience from beneath a cowl of vermilion.
"Motep," Cestus replied, taken a little aback by the Thousand Sun's demeanour. The Ultramarine wasn't alone. He had brought Excelinor, Amrix, and Leradis with him.
"The assault at Bacchae Triumvirum failed, didn't it?"
said the Thousand Sun.
"The enemy obviously had prior warning of our intentions. It is part of the reason I came here to meet with you."
"You believe that I can provide an answer to this conundrum?"
"Yes, I do," Cestus replied.
"It is simple," said Motep. "The word-bearers have made a pact with the denizens of the warp. They forewarned them of your attack."
"There is sentience in the Empyrean?" the Ultramarine asked in disbelief. "How is it we do not know this? Are the Primarchs privy to this? Is the Emperor?"
"That I do not know. All I can tell you is that the warp is beyond the comprehension of you or I, and things exist in its fathomless depths that are older than time as we know it."
Motep paused for a second, as if in sudden contemplation.
"Do you see them, son of Gilliman?" he asked, still locked in his meditative posture. "Quite beautiful."
Cestus followed the Thousand Suns' gaze to the viewport, and saw nothing but the haze of the integrity fields and the bizarre and undulating landscape of the warp.
"Don't make me regret what I am about to do, Motep," he warned, glad of his battle brother's presence behind him.
The Ultramarine captain had already dismissed the arms men guarding the door, an order they responded to with no shortage of relief. It was a moot gesture, really. Motep could have left at any time, irrespective of their presence. The fact that he had not somewhat mitigated what Cestus was about to say. That was before Motep preempted him.
"I am to be released."
It wasn't a question.
Yes, said Cestus carefully. We have a prisoner aboard and precious little time to find out what he knows.
I take it conventional methods have already failed.
Yes.
Small wonder, said Motep. Of all the children of the Emperor, the 17th Legion are the most fervent and impassioned. Mere torture would not prevail against such ardent fanaticism and zealotry.
We require a different tack, one which I do not relish undertaking, but which I am compelled to employ. Motep stood, setting back his hood, and turning to face Cestus.
Ultramarine, there is no need to convey your reluctance to me. I am sure the account of this day, if such records ever come to pass, given our current predicament, will state that you acted under the most profound duress, he said smoothly, the trace of a smile appearing on his lips before it was lost in the mask of indifference.
I do not know what powers you possess, brother, said Cestus. I had thought to make you stand trial and answer that question for me. It seems, however, that events have overtaken us.
Indeed, answered Motep. I am as moved by my duty as you are, Ultramarine. If I am freed, then I will fight as hard as any and pledge my strength to the cause.
Cestus nodded. His stern expression gave away the warring emotions within him. The abhorrence of flouting the Emperor's decree matched against the needs of the situation. Gather your armor, he ordered. Brothers Excelinor and Amrix will accompany you to the isolation cell.
Cestus about turned and was walking away with Liradis when Motep spoke again.
What of the son of Ross? What does he make of my emancipation?
The bellowing and violent protests of Bryngar were still ringing in the Ultramarine's ears.
Let me worry about that.
Cestus and Liradis were waiting when Motep, with Excelinor and Amrix in tow, reached them at the isolation cell.
Bryngar and Rougeveld had already stormed off in the wake of the Space Wolf captain's explosive discontent.
Cestus nodded to his battle brothers as they approached. The two Ultramarines reciprocated the gesture and fell in beside their captain.
The prisoner is within, the Ultramarine captain told Motep, who had reached the door and stood before it calmly.
Will you require Liradis's assistance? He added. You can have your chirurgeon go back to his quarters, replied the Thousand Son, his gaze fixed upon the sealed portal as if he could see through it.
Cestus nodded to his apothecary, indicating that his duty was done.
If Liradis thought anything of the slight that Motep had delivered, he did not show it. Instead, he snapped a sharp salute to his captain and left for his quarters as directed.
Motep thumbed the activation icon, and the portal slid open, showing the darkened cell.
Once it begins, he said, do not enter.
Motep turned to face the Ultramarine. No matter what you hear or see, do not enter, he warned, and all trace of superiority vanished from his face.
We will be outside, Cestus replied, Excelinor and Amrix grim-faced behind their captain, and watching everything you do, Thousand Son.
The Ultramarine captain indicated a viewport that allowed observation into the isolation cell.
I see anything I don't like, and you'll be dead before you can utter another word.
Of course, said Motep, unperturbed, as he entered the chamber, the door sliding shut in his wake.
Motep stepped carefully into the gloom, surveying his immediate surroundings as he went. Dark splashes littered the floor and walls. Even the ceiling was not devoid of the evidence of torture. A suit of armour had been thrown into one corner, together with a body glove that went beneath it. This was not considered disrobing by a coterie of acolytes. No, this was frenzied, an attempt to get to the soft meat of the flesh and exact pain and profound suffering. Motep's expression hardened at such barbarism. Implements, crude and brutish to the Thousand Sun's eyes, lay discarded on a silver tray, also speckled in blood. Some of the devices even bore traces of meat, doubtless rent from the unfortunate subject when his tongue failed to loosen under the fists of the Space Wolf. The chirurgeon's methods, then, had been equally ineffective.
"You are quite tenacious," Motep said.
There was a trace of menace in his calm inflection as he approached the metal cruciform frame to which the prisoner was affixed. The Thousand Son ignored the rapacious bruising, the cuts, gouges and tears that afflicted the subject's battered body. Instead, he focused on the eyes. They were still defiant, albeit slightly groggy from the beatings the prisoner had been given.
"What compromise you force us to endure,"
he whispered to himself, drawing close so that their faces almost touched.
"Tell me, what secrets do you possess?"
The response came stuttering through blood-caked lips.
"I serve only the word."
Motep reached for the scarab earring and removed it. He manipulated the small object with his thumb and forefinger and placed it upon his forehead, where it stayed affixed in the shape of a gold eye, the symbol of Magnus. "Do not think," he warned, placing his fingers against the prisoner's skull and pressing hard, "that you can hide from me." When Motep's fingers penetrated the flesh, the screaming began.